Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Campaign number 4. From The Times of Tri Men's Souls, The Crossing in the 10 Crucial Days. Retreat through the Jerseys in the Battle of Brenton, November 20th to December 26th, 1776. We pick up the story following the defeat of George Washington's army by the British in August of 1776, just 2 months after the Declaration of Independence, at the battle at Staten Island. Washington's army retreated to Manhattan and eventually made their way down through New Jersey. The British army and the German mercenary Hessians in pursuit. Washington's army ending up across the Delaware River in Pennsylvania, and the British army lodging in Trenton, New Jersey. In the Trenton area, groups of 50 or fewer American militiamen and Continentals carried out harassing attacks on the British. Hessian mercenary outposts, foraging parties, messengers, and patrols experienced hit-and-run skirmishes that took a mental as well as physical toll on the British. In the area south of Trenton, around Bordentown, Burlington, Morristown, and Mount Holly, a series of skirmishes occurred during the week before Christmas, 1776. At Morristown, Virginian Colonel Samuel Griffin gathered a small group of Virginia artillery and about 500 New Jersey militiamen from Cumberland, Salem, and Gloucester counties. Colonel Griffin arrived at Mount Holly, New Jersey on December 20th and found the enemy had abandoned its position, leaving supplies behind and fires burning. Colonel Griffin sent out after the British, but local British loyalists kept the British informed of his progress. The British had about 700 men and 3 cannon at Black Horse. On December 22nd, 1776, Colonel Griffin led his men in a skirmish at Petticoat Bridge near Mount Holly, New Jersey, killing several Hessian mercenaries and forcing them to retreat rapidly and abandon their knapsacks and other gear. British reinforcements advanced the next morning with 7 or 8 cannon, and the Americans retreated in good order. In a firefight that evening at Mount Holly, New Jersey, on Iron Works Hill, the Americans lost 2 killed and 7 or 8 wounded. Most of the American forces were then at Morristown, while Colonel Dunlop made his quarters at Mount Holly on December 23. These actions fatigued Colonel Dunlop's troops, but gave them confidence that the small American force could be easily defeated by the British. They also led Dunlop to center his attention on Mount Holly rather than at Bordentown, increasing his distance from Trenton, New Jersey, and widening the dispersal of his British troops. Although not connected to Washington's larger plan, Griffin's actions therefore materially supported it by hampering Colonel Dunlop's ability to support British General Rawl. The constant small attacks north and south of Trenton convinced the British and Hessians that they could expect a long and exhausting winter of harassment, but also that the Americans were in no condition to mount a significant attack from their positions in Pennsylvania. George Washington, meanwhile, developed a plan to reverse the downward course of the war based on his belief that he needed to cease retreating, achieve a symbolic battlefield victory, and at least partially drive the British forces out of New Jersey. The continuing daily loss of men to illness, enlistment expiration, and desertion complicated Washington's objective, down to a tiny fraction of the 20,000 men with which Washington had begun the year's campaign, and needing to assemble as large a force as possible, Washington had repeatedly ordered General Charles Lee to bring on his troops that had remained near New York during the autumn retreat in 1776. Only after the British captured General Lee on December 13th, however, did his successor, General John Sullivan, moved to unite the American army several days before Christmas. Washington's force then numbered about 2,400 cold, hungry, tired, and sick men. but even that was temporary since most Continental troops had enlisted only until the end of the year. The American Continental Congress had initiated the creation of a new Continental Army several months earlier, but recruits were hard to come by in a time of despair. The plan General Washington secretly developed with his generals aimed to defeat the outnumbered Hessians at Trenton, New Jersey, and simultaneously attack the Hessians and British dispersed in the Bordentown, Mount Holly area. Washington hoped to follow up with an attack on Princeton, New Jersey, and other containments before the British could react by consolidating their troops. As long as British forces remained dispersed, Washington's small army outnumbered the enemy at each of their containments. In addition to his main force encamped between Correale's and Yardley's ferries, Washington had approximately 1,500 Pennsylvania and New Jersey militiamen with General James Ewing opposite Trenton, New Jersey. The New Jersey militia system was in complete disarray. These men had joined Washington's force individually and in small groups before being organized into makeshift companies. Many knew Trenton and the area he would be traversing to attack it, and their knowledge about it would prove valuable. A third group of approximately 1,500 men at Bristol, under American Colonel John Cadwalder, was composed of a mixture of Pennsylvania militia and New England Continentals originally assembled to help defend Philadelphia and the surrounding area from British control. General Israel Putnam was working in Philadelphia to collect additional Pennsylvania militiamen who would join with Cadwalder's force to attack British Colonel Dunham's force south of Trenton, New Jersey. General Washington planned to cross the Delaware River into New Jersey with his army about 9 miles north of Trenton, beginning on the afternoon of December 25, 1776, and march overnight to attack the town around dawn on December 26. Simultaneously, Ewing's men would cross ferries just south of Trenton to support Washington and to prevent any Hessians from escaping to alert and join their forces near Bordentown, New Jersey. Cadwalder's force would cross at a ferry near Bristol to at least distract Dunham's Hessian and British forces, preventing them from supporting Colonel Rowell. Hopefully, Dunham's dispersed units would pull back and allow Cadwalder to join forces with Washington and continue attacking additional vulnerable containments. Colonel Johann Rowell commanded approximately 1,500 Hessians at Trenton. They comprised one grenadier and two fusilier infantry regiments, a company of about 50 light infantry Jager, three artillery companies with a total of 6 cannon, and about 20 British light dragoons. These men had served with skill and courage in the fall campaign. Their posting at Trenton, New Jersey, put them in a position of honor following military tradition, although contemporaries and historians could question Howe's wisdom in placing soldiers who did not speak English at such an advanced post. Although acknowledged as a skilled battlefield commander at Trenton, Colonel Rowell refused to build redoubts and did not provide his officers with a coordinated plan for defending an attack on his town by the Americans. Rowell simply did not believe that Washington had sufficient number of quality troops to mount a significant attack. Washington put his plan of attack into operation on the afternoon of December 25, 1776, hoping to get all troops and equipment across the Delaware River by midnight and attack Trenton before dawn. The American Continentals, with 18 artillery pieces and their horse-drawn ammunition and supply wagons, formed up to cross the Delaware River from McConkie's Ferry to Johnson's Ferry. The crossing required several types of river craft. Approximately 18 to 20 Durham boats that normally carried heavy bulk cargoes up and down the Delaware River, varying from 45 to 65 feet long, could carry troops and cross anywhere on the river. But the Americans also needed flat ferry barges to carry horses, artillery, and wagons. General Washington chose this crossing point because of its appropriate distance from Trenton, and also because the ferry owners were solid New Light Presbyterians and staunch patriots. To manage the boats while crossing the Delaware, Washington would rely on the multi-ethnic seafaring men of Colonel John Glover's 14th Massachusetts Regiment, called the Marble Headers, and local militiamen who knew how to operate the tricky ferry boats, which were attached to overhead lines that kept them on course on the river crossing. The day before the crossing, Washington selected from Ewing's camp a group of about 24 New Jersey militiamen who lived in the area and knew well the roads between Johnson's Ferry and Trenton, New Jersey. Two of these men were assigned to each brigade as guides. Even before the crossing commenced, the plan began to unravel. In Philadelphia, Putman decided he needed to stay put with the very few militia troops that he had gathered. The frigid weather deteriorated, and a storm set in that turned into an ugly northeaster. The weather and the nature of the Delaware River created different ice conditions at each crossing point. Where General Washington crossed, about 9 miles above Trenton, the river flowed continuously south, and various sized floating fragments of sheet ice that had formed upriver and broken off came downstream. These ice chunks were annoying and potentially dangerous, but not prohibitive to the crossing by Washington. At Trenton, where Ewing was to cross, the rapids in the falls at the river's head of navigation, combined with the tidal nature of the river below the falls to produce packed ice with only treacherous narrow lanes of rushing water. No one from Ewing's force was able to cross. At Bristol, the wider and tidal river caused ice to form from the banks towards the river's center. In places near the shore, ice was thick enough to support a man walking to a boat secured at the outer edge of the ice. The boat could cross to the opposite ice shelf, where the men could then walk across the ice to the shore. However, the ice was nowhere consistently thick enough to support horses, artillery, and wagons. Cadwalder did get some men across, but then recalled them when others, and especially artillery, could not follow him. So, Washington's force was the only one to cross successfully. Even he was considerably delayed by the river ice and the intense storm that developed. Despite the delay, Washington persisted in crossing everything, even the artillery. He had agreed with Colonel Henry Knox, his artillery commander, to take 18 artillery pieces, knowing that the Hessians only had 6. Despite the significant difficulties and delays encountered while crossing the artillery, Washington wanted to inspire his troops with the confidence provided by artillery support and demoralize the Hessians. As the weather deteriorated with wind-driven snow, sleet, and rain, the artillery took on even greater importance as the foul-weather weapon. It was easier to keep the bagged powder dry and fire an artillery piece in wet conditions than it was for the infantrymen to keep their musket powder dry. The crossing took about 3 in the morning to complete, putting Washington 3 hours behind schedule. 2 advance companies of 40 men each were sent on towards Trenton to set up roadblocks and prevent locals or any British patrols from learning of the American crossing. Close to 4 in the morning, the Army began its march from Johnson's Ferry to Trenton. Despite the darkness, weather conditions, and dirt roads, the American militia guides kept the men and horses on course. After marching uphill for about a mile, the column turned right toward Trenton and onto more level ground with the wind no longer directly in their faces. A ravine encountered at Jacob's Creek, which the guides had no doubt warned General Washington about, slowed the march considerably while the men helped the horses, wagons, and artillery down the steep slope, across the sweep, deep creek, and then up the opposite slope. Once past the ravine, the Army continued its march to the small crossroads village of Birmingham, about 4 miles from Trenton. There, General Washington and his officers synchronized their watches with his, and he split the force into 2 divisions. General Nathaniel Greene's division turned left and took the Upper Ferry Road to the Scotch Road, and then the Pennington Road, to arrive at the northern end of Trenton, while General John Sullivan's division continued straight out of Birmingham on a route paralleling the Delaware River to enter the town at its southern end. Both divisions reached and drove in the advanced Hessian guard posts almost a mile outside of town at about 8 that morning. The battle began with the heavily outnumbered Hessian guards retreating into town. The Hessian troops quartered throughout the town so they could not quickly turn out and form up for battle. Their dependents may have quartered in the stone barracks in the southern end of town. Two regiments, the Rahl and von Lossberg, managed to assemble under Colonel Rahl near the center of Trenton on King Street while being attacked by Nathaniel Greene's division from the north and west, including pouring artillery fire down the two main streets, King and Queen. Other elements of Nathaniel Greene's division continued to the northeast side of town to block Hessian escape, or British enforcements coming from Princeton. Colonel Rahl led his two outnumbered regiments east across Queen Street and into the area of an apple orchard, where the Hessians attempted to defend themselves and break out to the north. Finding himself nearly surrounded by the Americans, Colonel Rahl tried unsuccessfully to return into town. His men continued to fight in the orchard area until he received a fatal wound, and his two regiments surrendered to the Americans. The 3rd Hessian Regiment, the Knauphausen, formed up nearer to the southern end of the village and met Sullivan's division after it chased the 50 Jäger from the outpost into town and over the bridge at Assamick Creek. After some maneuvering, this regiment also surrendered, just ending the short Battle of Trenton. No Americans were killed, and only a few were wounded. These included Lieutenant James Monroe, who was severely injured with a severed carotid artery while attacking and capturing a Hessian cannon on King Street early in the fighting. 22 Hessians were killed and 83 were wounded, in addition to about 900 men captured. Several hundred Hessians had been able to escape by crossing the Assunpink Creek, which was undefended due to Ewing's failure to get across the river and fleeing to either Bordentown or Princeton. The town suffered much structural damage, and the street fighting had terrified the civilian residents. Word of the victory at Trenton led British Colonel Donop to order his troops to abandon the area and head toward the vicinity of Princeton, New Jersey. This allowed Cadwalder to cross his American troops the next day and prepare to join with General Washington. Washington won a significant victory, mainly because the enemy had dismissed him and his army as incompetents. The battle did not diminish the British Army's ability to pursue the conflict, but it did inflict a psychological wound and enhance the reputation of General Washington and his force. Immediately after the battle, Washington attempted to ferry his prisoners and their wives and children across the river to Pennsylvania, where they could be taken to Philadelphia and kept under guard. However, river ice prevented their removal. Not knowing his exact situation, or that of the enemy forces at Bordentown and Princeton, New Jersey, Washington marched his exhausted troops and their prisoners back to Johnson's Ferry and crossed over the Delaware back to Bucks County, Pennsylvania, through that night and into the morning. He left about 28 severely wounded Hessians, several of whom would die within a few days, at Trenton under the care of paroled Hessian medical officers. Washington spent the next several days removing his Hessian prisoners to Philadelphia and preparing his troops for further action in New Jersey. Because he could not risk appearing to retreat to safety in Pennsylvania, he returned his army to Trenton, New Jersey on December 30th and 31st and began preparations to defend the town. His army was growing in strength with the arrival of New Jersey and Pennsylvania militia units, encouraged by the victory at Trenton. At the same time, though, he was only hours away from losing his Continentals at the end of their enlistments. He and his officers pleaded with them to extend their enlistments for 6 weeks, telling them that in doing so they could render that service to the cause of liberty and to your country, which you probably never can do under any other circumstance. Washington also offered them a $10 bonus, equivalent to an extra month's pay, in addition to their regular pay. About half of veterans agreed to stay, while the rest left. With his officers and forces stationed at Trenton and Caldwell's nearby at Crosswicks, Washington sent out scouting parties towards Princeton, New Jersey, who informed him that British forces were concentrating there and planned to attack him on January 2, 1777. Washington also learned that a little-used back road, called the Sawmill Road, leading to the outskirts of Princeton. Between December 30th and January 1st, his troops established fighting positions on Mill Hill on the south side of Assunpink Creek, which ran through Trenton. On January 1st, Washington sent out about 1,000 men to set up several defensive positions where creeks crossed the main road to Princeton. Positioning troops on the rise behind each creek gave the Americans the advantage of high ground and the stream as a barrier. These small delaying parties would not fight for long against a vastly more numerous British army. However, they could temporarily halt the enemy, force them to deploy for battle, exchange volleys, and then fall back to another position while the British reformed their marching column. On the night of January 1, 1777, General Washington called for all of Cadwalader's troops at Crosswicks to join him by morning for the expected showdown with the British. He would then have almost 7,000 men, including remnants of veteran Continental regiments who had extended their enlistments, together with a large number of militiamen who had not fought at the Battle of Trenton. Most of the militiamen had not been in a significant battle. This mixed force would oppose approximately 8,000 veteran British and Hessian troops under General Lord Cornwallis. Early in the morning of January 2nd, General Lord Cornwallis began marching his British troops from Princeton in one long column down the main road to Trenton, leaving behind about 1,500 men as rearguard and 1,500 men more as reserves at Maidenhead between Princeton and Trenton. The combination of American delaying tactics and deep muddy roads, which resulted from temperatures rising into the 40s and melting the ice and snow, caused his British troops to use almost the entire day to march the 12 miles to Trenton from Princeton. Pennsylvanian Colonel Edward Hand organized the very effective American delaying actions. By the time the British chased Hand's forces back through Trenton and across the Assunpink Creek Bridge to Mill Hill, it was beginning to get dark. The two sides exchanged pounding artillery fire, and the British made three unsuccessful and bloody attempts to cross the bridge. Finally, darkness led British General Cornwallis to suspend the British assault and prepare to fight in the morning. He dispatched an order back to Princeton to leave just one regiment behind very early the next morning and send two regiments down to Trenton, along with some artillery, light dragoons, and a group of transient men looking to rejoin their regular British units. When the fighting ceased, British and American soldiers set up camp for the night, building fires for warmth and cooking. Both forces had suffered significantly higher casualties than in the first battle back on December 26, 1776. The Americans had about 100 killed and wounded, the Hessians about 140, and the British about 225. The town had suffered damage from artillery exchanges, further terrorizing civilians. But unlike Hessian Colonel Rahl, George Washington had prepared well and survived to fight another day. However, neither side looked forward to the morning. The outnumbered Americans had their backs to the Delaware River, and the British could take advantage of several fords further up the Assunpink Creek to outflank them. For their part, the British faced substantial American forces holding the high ground and supported by a large amount of artillery. Fighting an enemy entrenched on high ground presented a distasteful recipe for high casualties like at Bunker Hill back in 1775. Each side posted sentries and kept an eye on the other. Late in the evening, George Washington called a council of war at the house of Alexander Douglas. The dangerous situation therein was evident to each of his officers. No one wanted to retreat, but neither did they want to risk a tragic defeat at Trenton that could cripple the American war effort. Considering that the British only had about 1,500 men at Princeton, the number that Washington had defeated previously at Trenton, and knowing about British defenses and the little-used road, George Washington and his officers put together a plan to make an all-night march to Princeton by a route that kept them well away from the British troops at Trenton. They called in several local militiamen and interviewed each separately to compare their recommendations for a roundabout route avoiding the British Army. The chosen route, for which the men were designated guides, followed a road used by the Quakers to travel between the Princeton and Crosswicks meeting houses and joined the little-used back road that would allow them to surprise the British at Princeton. Following this route, General Washington would avoid renewed battle with British General Lord Cornwallis and instead take on an enemy force that he significantly outnumbered. After defeating that Princeton force, Washington could capture supplies the British left at New Brunswick and then march his troops to Morristown up in northern New Jersey. There they could take up defensible positions in the Wahkatyng Mountains, monitor the British in New York, and be on the flank of any British forces attempting to cross New Jersey during that winter or spring. The Council of War broke up, and the American officers returned to camp and quietly gave the order to break camp and form up to march. Some militiamen were assigned to stay behind and keep the fires burning all night. The American troops were not completely successful in concealing their departure from the British sentries, but when informed of perceived American movements, British General Lord Cornwallis discounted any danger. He simply thought the troops were moving to defend the fords up the Assapink Creek, or were preparing to cross those fords and surprise the British on their flank in the morning. Cornwallis' only response was to reinforce his troops at those crossings. Reading from the 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, Campaign Number 4, The Time That Tries Men's Souls, The Crossing, and the 10 Crucial Days, will be continued. This is Wallace Klinghast, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.